Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Well, if they engage in debt trap diplomacy elsewhere in the region, stands to reason they'll engage in that practice in Brazil. Now, Brazil is part of the BRICS compact, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And so they already have that sort of alignment with China.
Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford.
If for some reason they become beholden to the Chinese and they are highly leveraged, and that could happen, there is the real possibility that a JBS could become part of or a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party. And that would really be bad for the U.S. in terms of market share, total market share in the protein sector. It would be predominantly Chinese. That's one example. That may be an extreme example. Could it happen? Maybe. We'll see.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm surprised. I'm very surprised, especially with what happened this past week.
Representative Austin Scott from Georgia is a member of the House Ag Committee.
In my years here, which is 13 years here, I've never seen Republicans side with the Democrats to take down a procedural vote, a rule on the floor of the House of Representatives that happened this past week. It's a very small percentage of the Republicans that conducted themselves that way. I think it was 11. It may have been 12 on the final vote, but it's less than 5% of the Republican conference that has voted with the Democrats and kept a piece of legislation from coming to the floor the past week. And what we're here to talk about, if you looked at some of their comments that they made, one of the people in particular said that they wanted to make sure that there was no coalition put together to pass the Farm Bill or the National Defense Authorization Act or budget propositions. And that simply won't work, Tony. I mean, we've got to have a Farm Bill. 90% of production agriculture is in Republican districts. It's probably it and the NDAA are the two most important pieces of legislation to the people that I represent. And I never dreamed that Republicans from ag districts would think that you could balance the budget of the United States by eliminating the provisions for production agriculture, which account for 0.2% of total federal spending. And so I'm disappointed with what happened this last week. I'm disappointed with comments made by some of my colleagues, which represent, a very, very small fraction of the Republican Party. But we have a very small majority. And so when we have Republicans that go out and say that they won't vote for the Farm Bill under any circumstances, that's very disappointing to me. And it means it makes it that much harder for us to get a piece of legislation passed that supports production agriculture.
He also says as other members of Congress start looking to take down the Farm Bill, it's important to remember that even insurance doesn't make producers whole.
We work together in a bipartisan manner. Congressman Bishop, Sanford Bishop from Georgia's 2nd District, his staff, my staff, we all work together with other members. And I would remind you, the timber losses alone in Florida were $1 billion. Ultimately, the disaster package was about $3 billion. Nobody was made anywhere close to whole with what we did. But ad hoc disaster relief is not the way to provide a risk management tool for our farmers and our farm families. It takes too long for it to get to them. If they were totally dependent on ad hoc disaster relief, to be honest with you, they would probably be broke before it ever got to them. And so crop insurance and that system is the best thing that we can do for production agriculture, and that at least gives them the cash to make it through until any ad hoc disaster relief may be there. But again, you can't count on ad hoc disaster relief. You know, we need the commodity title. We need the crop insurance title. It accounts for 0.2% of total federal spending. It does tremendous amounts of good for our rural economies and our farm base in this country. And without those two things, I don't think you'll see production agriculture survive into the next generation. You may see corporate agriculture, but you won't see the farm family continuing to be out there doing what they do today, getting on the tractor and taking the risk that they take to grow a crop, to put that crop on the shelves for those of us in this country. The risk will just outweigh what they can handle financially.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
If you kind of look at where USDA has forecast prices for the 23 crop, they predict that cotton prices will average about 78 cents a pound, and that is not terribly exciting news to anyone that grows cotton because of the cost of production.
Kevin Brinkley is president and CEO of Plains Cotton Cooperative Association, or PCCA.
But we have to acknowledge that there's this tug of war in the futures market. First of all, it's very thinly traded at the moment compared to where it normally is. So the number of folks that have investments either as a hedger or a speculator is down from where it typically is. And that means that people are not interested in getting too committed one way or the other. So you've seen this trading range between the high 70s and the high 80s. And it's just kind of a tug of war, if you want to think of it that way. You know, you've got honestly, some pretty tight stock scenarios in some countries around the world. The U.S. would be, I think, considered one of those. On the other hand, you've got, recession fears that are out there. And so, when you have the Federal Reserve, they don't even know what to do with interest rates because of these same factors. It makes for some very interesting work trying to predict where prices are going to go. But again, I think if you're a producer, you've got to hope that they move higher because of the cost of growing cotton.
But anytime we stop and talk about cotton exports, we have to focus on China. What's the story there?
They still use roughly about one out of every three bales in the world is consumed by China. So that's a lot of concentration risk with one country. I think most growing regions of the world are trying to figure out how to deal with that. You know, for the U.S. and our part, we're looking at ways to build up other markets. And because of some of the geopolitical tensions with China that I think are probably going to persist for the next few years. But right now they have to be dealt with. And they have actually stepped back into the market for U.S. cotton. We got an export sales report this morning that China was the biggest buyer by far in that list. And, we have to acknowledge that they're very important to the income picture for our growers. So you look at China and you say, okay, well, what's going on with their economy? They were in lockdown for a lot longer than we were in most other world economies. And they've started to relax that over the last 2 to 3 months. And we had hoped to see more buying out of them as they came out of lockdown. And it's been a little bit behind pace from what we had hoped for. I think their mills are starting to use cotton at a rapid pace, and I think that's the reason for some of the buying we've seen in our export sales reports over the last few weeks. Probably, a bit more to go in terms of their domestic consumers actually buying cotton and really kind of lighting a fire under the market. And so we're hopeful that they do that while acknowledging that we have to work on other markets as well so that we can get the best possible price for our producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Research has been an area that I've majored in on the Ag Committee.
Nebraska Representative Don Bacon, a member of the House Ag Committee.
It was our push to get the foot and mouth disease vaccine bank, and I'm so proud that it's operational today. But we don't need research money to figure out African swine fever, for example, and just basic livestock or animal diseases that we can work on. And I'd like to point out, too, in the 1930s, we were getting about 35 bushel an acre for corn. Now we're over 200 bushel. So research pays off. And for about every dollar you put in, you get $4 back. And so I'm a big believer in investing. We have a great university with University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and Omaha, and Kearney, for that matter, that does a lot of great research and does a lot of support for our farmers and ranchers.
He also is concerned about cybersecurity issues.
Well, we know the Russians and Chinese and also just the criminal element out there try to exploit what they see as the weakest links, whether it's ransomware, you know, they'll take down a business and demand several hundred thousand or maybe even millions if it's a larger business. And so we need to do more to protect our farmers. You know, we have so many internet protocol or IP connections, whether it's our combines, pivot irrigation. The average farmer today has tons of this stuff. And I think it makes us more vulnerable to bad actors, let alone foreign actors that wish us harm. So we should be investing significantly in agriculture, cybersecurity. And I know University of Nebraska, Omaha is doing a lot of work on this. But it's very important. Bad people are trying to target our farmers and our ranchers, so we got to be ready.
What's the latest on the GMO corn ban out of Mexico?
Finally, the administration has stepped up. They've been silent for too long. We have a trade deal with Mexico. All the stuff's already been worked out. For them to now come in and say they're not going to take our GMO corn is a violation of the agreement we have with USMCA. And we expect our administration to speak up and defend our farmers. They have. A little late to the table, but we need them to be forceful with Mexico on this. We have an agreement. They should live up to it. And there's nothing wrong with our GMO corn. In fact, that's why we're leading the world in production and yield. This stuff has, you know, been carefully looked at by our scientists, and they're there to increase yield, protect our crops, and that's why we have it.
Which just highlights the importance of trade.
Nebraska leads the country for trade in beef. We're very high in ethanol, popcorn, of course, corn and soybeans, and pork. There's so much that we trade, and we're an export state, one of the top five, I believe, export states in the country. So we want to open more doors. And again, I am critical of the administration in this area. They've been largely silent when it comes to the trade and working out new trade agreements with countries in the Far East. I did see a positive development where Taiwan, we're starting to near a trade deal with them, but we should be doing this all over the world. And with our our competitive advantage is agriculture, and we can feed much of the world. We'd like to have an administration that is advocating more for us. So yes, we want to trade more beef to China, more beef to Indonesia, more pork and throughout the world. And again, we're also leaders in ethanol and popcorn. I mean, so there's so much more we could do.
But there are some wondering whether Congress can pass a farm bill before it expires in September.
We should get the farm bill done this summer, and we'll reconcile it with the Senate version, hopefully in the fall. And I think all the controversial items have already been worked out. I'm an optimist.
Nebraska Representative Don Bacon. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's a... one of the largest voluntary conservation programs in the world.
Talking Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, Zach Ducheneau, Administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency.
In the 2018 Farm Bill, we were given what we took as a target of 27 million acres to enroll. Right now, we're around 24 million with the 1 million acres that we've enrolled this year that we've accepted offers on, and a record interest in our grassland CRP program again, as well as some really pivotal, game-changing CREP agreements, Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. So there's two sign-up periods for our CRP program. The general sign-up, which wrapped up April 27th, I believe maybe April 7th, but earlier in the spring, and then Grassland CRP has a sign-up that closed the end of May. In addition to those two sign-up periods, there are continuous opportunities to enroll in this conservation program, and that's our continuous CRP, which includes the Clear 30 initiative for water and water quality enhancement, the Safe Acres program, which is about wildlife habitat in the states, and then the CREP agreements that we have all across the country. A couple of examples of those I think are really helpful, Tony, to help people understand the breadth of opportunity. We were just over in Colorado for the signing of the Republican River CREP agreement, and in that agreement, we're helping producers enroll in this conservation program as a means to transition away from irrigated practices that they were going to be forced out of anyway because of water compact issues. So it helps them make that transition on their terms, realize a rental income, get some incentive payments to help establish a vegetative stand, and transition into the next iteration of agriculture on their operation. Another example I like to highlight is the work that we're doing in Indian country. We just signed our first CRP contract under the CREP agreement with the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. And that opportunity has the potential to bring 1 million acres of grassland into the Conservation Reserve Program in one of those communities that had really, frankly, been marginalized in the past in the USDA's approach to serving producers.
For a program that started nearly 40 years, adjustments have to be made.
The CRP program, as you mentioned, started in 85, and we were at home smack in the middle of the farm financial crisis, so conservation measures were really the last thing on our mind. We were just trying to preserve. The changes that we were able to make in 2021 have really helped turn the interest in the program back around. We added some climate smart practice incentives and increased the payment rates in some cases to help producers have a meaningful opportunity to consider that as a viable part of their economic operation. And as you recall, it was created to help remove some of these more environmentally sensitive areas from that form of production, establish a vegetative cover, establish a wildlife habitat. More and more, we're talking about CRP in the context of a working lands program, because I think it's a misconception that conservation and production have to be separate. With our grassland CRP program, it is an effective working lands program where producers are paid an incentive payment to change their grazing practices that will help improve and enhance cover, improve wildlife habitat, improve soil health, which is going to, by definition, increase the productivity of their farm and the gain of their livestock.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, I think it's always a big mystery what we're going to see in a final rule, but certainly it's been a long wait.
That's Alexa Kombelek, the Director of Government Affairs, American Soybean Association.
We saw the draft rule for the 2023 to 2025 volume years from the EPA back in December, and this is setting the volumes for renewable fuels through the next several years, right? And so it will sort of dictate where the market is going. We thought we were going to see that rule on Wednesday, June 14th, and that was not the case. We got a one-week delay, and so we are eagerly awaiting what's going to be in that final rule. I will say that draft rule had very, very low increases in volumes for biomass-based diesel and advanced biofuels, which was really disappointing to ASA and to others in this space. It was about 10% of what the Energy Information Administration anticipates the demand to be over the next 3 years. And so after 2 years where EPA set the highest volumes ever in 2021 and 2022, we sort of thought this was going in the same direction and were surprised when those volumes were so low. So we provided them with all of the information that we had, whether that was, information about planting and yields and increased crush capacity and all of the things that the industry is investing in. With all of that, we're hopeful that EPA recognizes that there is a demand for more and that their work is going to help move this market in the right direction. So we may not see that level where we would like to see it. We had, as an industry, had requested a 500 million gallon increase every year, which is lower than what the demand is estimated to be. But we're hoping to move the needle in the right direction. And so I guess all eyes are on Wednesday to see what will happen.
Could it be driven by the administration's push for renewables?
And that was one of the reasons we thought we would see higher volumes. You have the president who issued the Sustainable Aviation Fuel, or SAF, grand challenge to work to decarbonize the aviation sector. That's something that the biodiesel and other renewable fuels industries are extremely interested in. It is certainly going to be, the fuel for the future in airlines. I don't think we're going to see battery-powered airplanes anytime soon. But additionally, we see that there is going to be a huge increase in demand for locomotives, for heavy-duty trucks, for other things. And, with that, we're also seeing the administration looking not only at new markets for these fuels, but new ways to get those fuels to market. The last few administrations have worked hard with the Higher Blends Infrastructure Incentive Program, which is housed over at the USDA. And that program provides grants to different entities that are looking to distribute biofuels in a way to get them to consumers faster. Here in the DMV area, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, the farmers out here who are growing soybeans would love to be using biodiesel as much as their counterparts in the Midwest on their farms to sort of have that full circle sustainability story of soybeans. And it's really difficult to get it out here. Depending on where you are, it might be, you know, nearly impossible for someone to find biodiesel available for sale, you know, within a 20-mile radius of them. So programs like this help get that infrastructure out here. And every time grants are released, they are eaten up right away. There's not a dollar left. And so we know this program is working. We know that it's highly desirable, and we're looking forward to seeing that continue.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I think we have a reputation of knowing that all our policy comes straight from the farm, from through our county farm bureaus to their state and up to the national level.
Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall.
I think everyone here in Washington, D.C. and other ag groups understand how good that policy procedure is, and the people on Capitol Hill understand when we speak for the farmer and not for an organization or just a board of directors, but for all the farmers across the country.
Your pathway to the presidency here in Washington, did you really set out to do that? How'd that come about?
No, not really. I graduated from high school, loved cows, was raised in dairy business, and went off to college, and couldn't get back home quick enough to milk the cows. For some reason, I was one of those dairymen that loved their cows, and my dad had a heart attack, and I came back home, spent 30 years in dairy business, and during that time, I realized that there were a lot of things going on in my state capital, in my county government, in my national government that needed a voice. And I looked for a place to apply that voice, and it was in Farm Bureau. My dad encouraged that and told me I should manage my time to where I could spend some time outside my fence rows to make a difference in policies that not only affect me, but affected rural communities and farms all across the country.
Now, you had a group of leaders in and future leaders in, fly in. Why is that important?
Well, a farmer really doesn't realize until he makes this trip how important it is for him to sit in front of his own congressman and his own senator and tell his story. Like right now, we're right in the thick of talking about a farm bill. And for a farmer from a congressman's area that he represents, come in and tell his story how the farm bill has sustained his farm over years. Not every year, because we don't need it every year, but a lot of years when we have disasters or when prices are bad or whatever, that risk management tool that's in the farm bill helps us get through that rough time, get to the next year, plant a crop so that we can keep every American's pantry full across America. That is it's not just a safety net for farmers. It's a safety net for every American across here that has to feed their family each and every day. That's why when you go to a grocery store, the shelves are full, because the farmers are out there, and also the farm bill's there to make sure that they're there to continue to produce.
Finally, kind of bringing this full circle, we've talked about your pathway. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the next generation of leaders coming up, but taking that first step, does that happen at the county level? And what words of encouragement would you give to a farmer, rancher, dairyman to get involved?
Same advice my dad gave me when I was sitting at his breakfast table complaining about regulation and milk prices and milk inspectors and people not showing up for work. And he says, if you want to make a difference in those areas, you got to get outside your fence row. It is our job as businessmen to take care of our business. And all of our business is not inside of our fence row. A lot of it goes on outside of our fence row. And we all need to participate. And if you're out there by yourself, that lone voice in the distance doesn't make anything happen. But when you join an organization like Farm Bureau, where we all join our voices together with one united voice, it becomes a powerful thing. And you really don't know that until you visit this place and realize how well Farm Bureau is respected on Capitol Hill and across town.
So good to see you. Thanks for your time. Thanks for the work you do.
Thank you. I encourage everybody to come be part of our Farm Bureau family. We need their voice. regardless of how big or small you are or where you come from.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Also, you have three district courts that have said that this rule is likely illegal. They have granted preliminary injunctions to prevent the rule from going into effect in 27 states.
That's Courtney Briggs with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
It's really quite telling that you have landowners throughout the country saying that this is a bad rule. You have Congress in a bipartisan fashion, and these days it's very hard to get anything supported in a bipartisan fashion and across the finish line to the president's desk. But unfortunately, with the president's veto authority, with one stroke of the pen, he rolled back the will of Congress there. And now you have three district courts saying it's likely illegal. And finally, the cherry on top of the cake is the Supreme Court saying that it's an illegal rule.